This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. On March 11th, 1892, the first public basketball game was played at the YMCA in Springfield, Massachusetts, and it was recounted in the Springfield Republic newspaper as basketball football game. This paper from March 12th is an important artifact in the history of basketball. However, exactly 8 months later, another piece of paper would be created that would change the course of sports in ways that nobody saw coming. And that's where we left off last week, asking Joe Horrigan, what one artifact would he save from the Football Hall of Fame? And it all revolves around a guy named Pudge.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is November 12th, 1892, and we are in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're here to witness some football history. And as alluded to, this day, there was an artifact that was created, a piece of paper. Maybe an artifact that Joe Horrigan would take with him when he's running out of the Pro Football Hall of Fame if he could only take one. And speaking of that, this is where we left off with last week's episode. This is part two of the interview. So if you didn't listen to part one, you probably should mash that pause button and go listen to that first. But before we get into everything, we have a word from our official sponsor for this episode. And this week's sponsor is the Professional Football Researchers Association, which is a nonprofit educational organization that's dedicated to preserving and promoting the history of professional football. Formed in 1979, the organization has regularly published its magazine, The Coffin Corner, as well as a host of books. Their website has articles, game books, line scores, and a multitude of other archival materials for researchers as well as fans of the game. This is available all for members. Every 2 years, the PFRA holds their convention with guest speakers and special events. To find out more information about the PFRA or to join this organization, go to their website, which is profootballresearchers.com. Also, you can follow them on Twitter at Football History or follow them on Instagram at PFRA_photos. And speaking of the Professional Football Researchers Association, we've mentioned them well throughout this podcast, as I've used them extensively for research myself. We've even brought on many of their members to be interviewed as part of our guests. So I definitely recommend going and checking them out. Again, that's at profootballresearchers.com. And we even talked about it last week with Joe Horrigan. He was one of the founding members. We might dive a little bit of that again in this week's episode. But last week, I promised you we were going to give away an autographed copy of Joe's book, NFL Century, The 100-Year Rise of America's Greatest Sports League. So, we had a contest, and we have a winner. That winner is Peter Stilato. Congratulations, Peter. Your book will be on its way. But for the rest of you, no worries. You can still purchase this incredible book to add to your collection, or even send it to a friend for a gift. I have links to this book and also our sponsor over on the website, which you can get to through your podcast player or by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com, which of course takes you over to my page on the Sports History Network, which is the headquarters for your favorite sports yesteryear. And while you're at it, don't forget to subscribe for free to this show by mashing that little subscribe button on your podcast player of choice. That way you get the hottest, freshest off the press episodes well each and every week. But for now, let's get back into the interview with Mr. Pro Football Hall of Fame, Joe Horrigan. Christopher Lawton from 99yards.com, one of his questions was, what artifacts in the hall fascinate you the most? Or what would be, like, if you could only take one and you're running out of the building, which one would it be?
Well, you know, I guess, and this is almost a chronological answer, is the one thing that we do have is the one-page document that literally indicates the first known player to accept money to play the game, which is kind of the birth certificate for pro football, Pudge Heffelfinger. There is a document from the Allegheny Athletic Association's ledger book where it indicates he's being paid $500 to play one game. So that would be the, you know, that's the where the game began. So I think I would grab that and make sure it didn't go up in flames or whatever, whatever your disaster is that you're really offering.
Hopefully we never deal with that.
But because it's virtually all of the artifacts in the Hall of Fame are one of a kind. And, you know, when something is one of a kind, it's not so much what their monetary value is, what is their replacement value. When, if it's unique, it can't be replaced. So, you know, I always say this when somebody asks me, you know, what's the most significant thing? I said, everything is significant. I said, there are just things, some things that are harder to replace and some things that are impossible to replace. So I could, you know, list hundreds in each category.
Right. Yeah. I think it goes back to the, like you said, the paper documents and what that person, what that artifact means to the story of that person that's being asked that question. Like you said, with Pudge Heffelfinger, were you there when, was it John Brolier that they thought was originally the first?
No, that happened just before I got here. My predecessor, Don Smith, one of my predecessors, you know, I kind of, three people along the way, but Don Smith was the man who hired me. Made the connection between that document and a paper that we had in our archives, which our archives, we, you know, it was a file cabinet. It was a paper that Dan Rooney gave to the Hall of Fame, done by, and Dan couldn't remember the gentleman's name who brought it to him. And as close as he could come, he called him Nelson Ross or something like that. So forever, it's known as the Nelson Ross paper. Although Bob Carroll and I spent countless hours trying to figure out who Nelson Ross might have been. We weren't able to figure it out, but Nelson did a terrific chronology of the professional game that became kind of the template for really a lot of research going forward. And it was he that talked about Pittsburgh Athletic Club and the Allegheny Athletic Association and what they were doing. And we believe that that document must have come from him as well as a part of his research. But we don't know that for sure. But in any case, that document was literally on display at the Hall of Fame in the same exhibit where they're talking about John Brolier being the first pro. And it was Don, who was fairly new at the time when he put two and two together, said, you know, this doesn't quite jive, I don't think, here. And he read the Nelson Ross report and got the kind of the general idea of the thing. Although for Don, you know, not being an historian of the, you know, of the game's antiquity, he didn't understand all of what he was reading, but he could see that there was definitely something here. This Heffelfinger guy was a pro.
Right. Yeah. There's some discrepancy here. What's going on with this? Is that why it's called the Nelson Ross Award? Because of.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Nelson Ross is a guy. We don't even know who he is. it was just a name Dan Rooney assigned to the paper.
Right. Yeah. That's funny. I always saw the Nelson Ross Award, but I didn't even know like where it came from or who he was.
We had always hoped that somebody would come before and say, my name isn't Nelson Ross. And it never
happened. So you mentioned that it was in the exhibits and you were responsible a lot of times for the transitions. Like how would you even, or you and your team choose what was going to be exhibited at what time and how did that process work?
Well, you know, it's a combination of things. First, if you're going to exhibit something, you have to look at where's the strength of your collection. And then you try to build from the strength of the collection into the story you're trying to tell. So from the very beginning, the Hall had chosen to do kind of two different presentation styles. One was a chronological presentation, and then the other was subject. So you could just pick specific subjects and focus on them. They didn't have to be chronological per se. So in the chronological exhibit area, which was the round building, the original building in the Hall of Fame, it was a rough chronological approach to the history of the game, using the artifacts from the collection that we had, supplemented obviously with images to either bolster the explanation of a physical artifact or to fill the gap where there were no physical artifacts. And then you used, we still had the great asset of NFL films. We used video clips, slide projectors, which were state of the art at the time, to tell a story and, you know, listen to audio interviews and that sort of thing. So that was fairly easy. But through the rest of the museum, we developed thematic stories. And that became a little more challenging because there's so many great stories, but we wanted to do justice to the ones that were most significant. So as we expanded the building, that was more the challenge, was we had to continue that chronological approach, but the building itself you know, was filled around building, you know, the first 100 years, right? Where do you go after that? You know, you got to keep building and growing the story. So you have to cut it off at a certain point, pick it up somewhere else in the building. And then obviously significant stories like we did, you know, the African-American, the road to equality. We wanted to talk about that in the context of the history of the game, the other leagues that competed against the National Football League, American Conference, the various AFLs, the World Football League, the USFL, wanted to tell their story. We weren't looking to be the be-all to end-all to every story, but we wanted to at least acknowledge that this is a part of history, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in the chronological presentation up here, which was pretty much NFL. That is, of all the other leagues, they don't even come close to adding up combined to a history as long and significant as the NFL's. So it was you know, decisions like that that we had to make. And then obviously the game continues. We have a story that has a beginning and has no end. So we want to be contemporary. We gather artifacts as they are occurring. Today's history, today's current event is tomorrow's history. So you, rather than hope you can find, you know, an artifact from a game 20 years ago, why not get it while it's happening? It's still significant. It involves, that helps to involve the contemporary players to feel a part of the Hall of Fame, because we do represent pro football, not just our Hall of Famers. So we did that. Most recently, we've made space in our museum to have a museum within a museum. We're the permanent home for the Black College Football Hall of Fame. And that was a major move on our part, you know, because we are pro football, but you know, this is Black College Football, which most people don't understand what that is. Black College Football was football played at HBCUs, what are now called HBCUs, but in their infancy, they were, in their early years, they were just simply called Black colleges. And the reason they existed is Black men weren't allowed to go, Black men and women were not allowed to attend white colleges and universities. So these schools, largely started by religious groups or even government, state legislatures and governors, to keep segregation alive, started these schools. So it really wasn't until, and strangely enough, Black colleges had football being played in at their schools starting in 1892, the first year that pro football started. So there's this parallel universe, as Sam Friedman calls it. Sam's a great author and columnist from the New York Times, did a great book on Black college football. But in any case, where college football and Black college football ran on parallel tracks, there were no Black players in the there are a handful of Black players in major colleges, very, very few, mostly in the Ivy League. And then there were no Black colleges in pro football from 1933 to 1946, only 13 between 1920 and 1933. So the reason that it becomes an important part of the pro football story is we celebrate the reintegration of football when Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color barrier. Well, the year before, Woody Strode, Kenny Washington, Mary Motley, and Bill Willis broke pro football's color barrier. Well, we celebrate that, but we don't tell the story of why there was a color barrier and what was going on in football during that period. Were there no Black players? Well, certainly there was. There was, you know, Black players were all over the place. They just weren't being invited to play professionally. So we felt that tying the marriage between the story of why there were none to how we now have so many great African-American athletes, and in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I think we're at 23 members of the Black College Football Hall of Fame are also members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, to which I would argue, imagine how many more there would be had they been allowed to play pro football from 1920 to 1960, whatever. So that's the reason why it fits very nicely in the context of Pro Football Hall of Fame, because it really is a part of the story of the evolution of the game to where it is today.
And you mentioned the Hall of Famers, and then, of course, when people go, a lot of times what we think of the Hall of Fame is the bust room. I mean, how did that start off at the beginning? Like, what was the idea of we're going to put busts in the hall like this?
Yeah, it was Dick McCann, the first director of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And Dick was a general manager of the Washington Redskins prior to joining the Hall of Fame. It was his idea, and he literally enlisted a local sculptor, Jack Worthington, who was a very good sculptor, to do the charter class. And, you know, there was only, you know, they're only going to have 17 busts. They get this big room to put. So they knew that they was going to have a growth potential, but they never, I don't think, ever really thought what happens when we fill this little room up, and then we built another room, and that filled. And so it became a challenge. But the idea really was not to be like baseball and have a plaque. We wanted to, you know, there's the old story about George Halas and the Chicago Bears. He said, if baseball are, if Chicago Cubs are Cubs, Chicago football team, football players are bigger. They got to be Bears. Well, it was kind of that philosophy. If baseball is using a plaque, I think psychologically that they thought, well, if there's plaques here, we're going to do busts. It wasn't really anything more than just what was, I guess, you know, when you typically think about presidents, you know, there's a presidential bust that you see. You're not going to make a statue for everybody, but that bust may, might be something that really is elegant, permanent, and really top-notch that could set them aside. It really became their iconic symbol, you know, which we say there are now three, the bronze bust, the gold jacket, and the Hall of Fame ring. But the bronze bust was truly the first and the most significant, the one that everybody recognizes.
Right, yeah, and how don't they last a considerable amount of time as long as they're...
Yeah, well, our sculptor, our principal sculptor today, a gentleman named Blair Buswell, who's been doing them since 1975, I think.
Wow.
Tremendous talent. He's a world-renowned artist now. But he's the one that used a year. You know, we asked him once, you know, how long should these last? He was, 40,000 years. And, you know, it's like, well, how do you know that? You know, why not 39,994? You know, who knows? So it was just, he was talking in terms of the meteorological, metallic life of the materials he's using. But he really has no idea.
Right.
Yeah. Since 1963, we've never had one melt.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's not like 40,000 years down the road, we're going to be, that's a long time.
Who's going to ever challenge him to tell him he was right or wrong?
Right, exactly. So with that being said, too, I mean, the whole presentation, they get to the first time. It's so cool when they're able to see their bust for the first time. But you, going back before that, it takes, what, geez, by the time they find out, to the time they're inducted, that's 6 months or so. And
yeah, they've always had the meeting. Well, I should say always, for the most part, always. Yeah, within the first, after the first couple of years, they've had the selection meeting at the Super Bowl, the day before the Super Bowl, because that's one place where all of the selectors would be. They're all members of the media, so they would be at the Super Bowl. So it was convenient, and that would typically be earlier on in January than now later into February. They'd be elected at that point, but and we would let them know right away. But as you point out, the enshrinement ceremony wasn't until late July or early August. And that was really because that's when we wanted to do the event in the summertime when the weather permitted. Plus, was also prior to the beginning of the season, the football season. It gave us our own weekend, but close enough to the beginning of the season that the mood was already there. So it just kind of worked out that way. But even now, you know, our selection process is a year-round process. You know, we have reduction voting, and each of these steps are national televised shows, like I mentioned earlier. But so the process literally begins right after that meeting in February. We start sending the selectors their first preliminary list of carryover nominees and ask them to add to it. Then we add to it the first year eligible. Then we add any nominations we receive from the public, and the list keeps growing, and we continue to provide them to the selectors, eventually get them to the point where we ask them to take that first preliminary list, which is usually about 120 to 130 names, many of whom are repeats from previous years, and reduce it to 25. So the athletes themselves know, starting in, I guess it's September, we do that first reduction, that, hey, I'm on the list now. You know, it's a whole year before he ever finds out or goes through the process, if in fact he becomes elected. So it keeps the not only the process and the news and the momentum going for the, you know, the enshrinement ceremony and the relevance of the Hall of Fame itself, but it does, you know, it's torture for the guys that are the nominees. It truly is.
And I bet.
And particularly for those that may not get elected, you know, then it's another whole cycle to go through. I often ask people, and I'll ask you, I said, you know, if you were to be asked, Lynn Swann, the great wide receiver with the Pittsburgh Steelers, was he elected in his first year, second year, or third year of eligibility?
Yeah, I wouldn't even know.
It was his 14th.
Oh, my goodness.
So he was a finalist 14 consecutive years. He had to go through this process 14 times. By the time he got elected, you know, it was kind of like, it's about time, guys. I was playing golf. I wasn't even going to answer the phone. So it can be pretty tough.
You bring up a good point there too. I was playing golf. I wasn't going to answer the phone, and that's different than how it is nowadays. How did that happen? And weren't you involved in calling them at one point in time?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I used to call them all and tell them that they made it. And, you know, we were again with our partner with the NFL Network, originally ESPN, was televising our press conference, but just kind of sending it back to Bristol for, you know, here's an update. This is happening. But when we started with NFL Network, we began doing a live press conference. And literally, that's what Rich is telling the story, where I'm telling him I'm calling these guys and I'm saying, hey, just talk to so-and-so. I'm not sure he's all there. You know, be gentle. But the process was I'd get the envelope, you know, after the meeting and literally open it up and read the names and start dialing phone numbers from a phone bank I had in the back of the press conference room and alerting them. And we would, if that, from those finalists, some of them ultimately were in the Super Bowl site city for various reasons. You know, they might be doing promo work or with their team or whatever. And if they were, we would always alert them, you know, since you're a finalist, be somewhere close so that if we call you, we can get to the press conference right away. So that's what we would do with NFL Network. We would stash somebody in the green room so they could at least start their press conference if we thought this guy had a reasonable chance of being elected. Sometimes it didn't happen. It wasn't a pleasant experience. But, you know, you took that chance. If we explained to them, you know, it may not happen. Are you willing? And they'd say yes. So anyway, they'd always have a first guy. And in the meantime, I'm in the back room calling on the phone if they're not in town and then patching through live to Rich on the stage where he talks to me via the phone. Well, that was, you know, how we did it for a number of years. Well, it became, you know, tough, let's just say, on the Hall of Famers. You know, they're sitting by their phone, and sometimes we couldn't get to them to tell them that they weren't elected, and they would hear it on television.
Oh.
I'm one guy dialing three phones at the same time, and phones are busy, and you're trying to got to get the guys that made it first, and all that. So it was uncomfortable. So what we did do is we worked out with the NFL. They had decided to do the awards show on that Saturday night before the Super Bowl. We said, well, you know, they came to us and said, wouldn't it be nice that we had all of the new class as a part of the show? I said, that'd be great, except they're never at the, you know, they're never there. I mean, so we worked out a deal where they now bring in all 18 of the finalists with the understanding that if you are elected, we would expect you to go to the honor show. And we put them in a hotel and we tell them kind of the same thing that, you know, once we get the envelope, we will call you before we go on the air and tell people and let you know whether or not you were elected. David Baker, president and CEO of the Hall of Fame, we started something with him. We kind of came up with the idea of, wouldn't it be great, since we have them there, that you went to the door and told them, you know, I don't know how you're going to do it if there's eight guys, but, you know, we'll try it. So anyway, it became very popular. Now it's part of the football lexicon, the knock. You've seen the reactions. We've had Phil Cruz follow them through to show the emotion of a guy being elected to the Hall of Fame. But it's still just as painful to have to make that phone call quickly to those that don't make it, many of whom have been rejected. I should say rejected, have been eliminated for that year on other occasions. So it's always, you know, mixed emotions
right,
coming out of the room. I feel great when somebody's elected, but I feel also pretty badly if somebody, particularly when I've known them or know them and how many years they've waited and so on, you feel bad for them and their family.
Yeah, I think the one that David Baker brought up when I had him on the show, he mentioned Ray Guy and how he called him on the phone.
He fell down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought he had a heart attack.
Yep. And so speaking of that too, so you get them there, they're elected, and then they go up on stage for Selection Saturday and the award show. What's the process for the next 6 months of their life or your life for them?
Well, their life becomes very, you know, we try to tell them that this is a life-changing event for you. And for many who've been out of the game for a long time, it puts them back in the spotlight, some place that they have not been for a while. And others who have been in the spotlight even now are much more in demand. We start literally the morning after that honor show. We get them together for a private, well, start really at about 7:30 in the morning for a private session where we begin the process of measuring them for their ring, for their bronze bust. They meet with the sculptor to do some preliminary measurements. They get fitted for their gold jacket. We have an orientation breakfast that then becomes an orientation lunch, at which we you know, kind of tell them, here's what to expect. Hear a little bit from each of the staff. We meet with them. for the various functions, whether it's a sponsorship opportunity that they might have, explain that, or try to tell them about their speeches. You know, keep it short. They never really listen, but, you know, we try to go through it with them. And then, you know, it's really get to know the staff, those of us who might not know them, or they might not know everybody, you know, so that they know who they're dealing with. Here's the person you're going to talk to about this. We're going to be your best friends for the next 6 months. And then they're going to come to Canton later on, in early spring, to do a site survey to see, you know, we'll literally walk them out on the stage, show them where it's going to be, how it's going to be. This is where the, you know, the fans are, the cameras are going to be looking at you. You'll be walking from here to here to, you know, we rehearse it literally. And then they start looking at venues around town because they all want to have a big party to celebrate. That becomes a big part of their experience. And unfortunately, it falls on usually their significant other to do the planning. I'll work with them on their speeches. We get them, you know, guys that are really diligent, you know, 5, 6, 7 iterations of the speech, trying to, you know, get it within a timing. I hate to give up the time, and they all swear it's 14 minutes or less, and it never is. But, you know, but it's, you know, like I say, you know, when it's all over with, I'm annoyed sometimes they don't listen, but if it's a good speech, I'm really happy.
Right, yeah.
LaDainian Tomlinson gave the best speech I've ever listened to at the Hall of Fame, but it was the final 5 minutes of what was about a 24-minute speech.
Right, exactly.
But the other 18 minutes, who cares? You know, that last 5 minutes is so impactful, and it's been replayed and replayed, and it was LaDainian Tomlinson. The rest were thank yous, you know, and maybe his story a little bit, but not so much. The last, you know, that last 5-7 minutes was just unbelievable. And I wouldn't have given it up for, if he told me he's going 30 minutes just to get there, I would have said, yeah, let's do it.
But yeah, that's definitely worth it at that point. And like, so is it set up where the broadcast is just, it's known that it's just going to go until it's done, or is there like a hard cutoff point normally?
You know, like, just like I yell at the Hall of Famers, the networks yell at me, you know, so it's, you know, we're going to shut it off if you don't, you know, and I say, I know. No, we're going to have to start going to commercial breaks, and eventually they will, because, you know, there are years where we're close, you know, here's how many minutes we think it's going to be. And they adjust, you know, it's, you know, we would like it to be about a 2-2.5 hour show. They know, you know, after doing it for so many years, it's going to be 3-3.5 or longer. And they stay with it. And the ratings have bared it out for them. You know, it's not like, you know, we're smart enough to put a high-profile guy at the back end and start with a high-profile guy and so on. But, you know, the opportunity to tune in and out is there, you know, if you are so inclined. But the future probably is maybe a tape delay where they can do some editing so that they don't have to interrupt with commercials, but they can eliminate some of the superfluous introductions and that sort of thing. Right now, the live audience sees even more than what the live TV audience does because we get a lot of the pre-show stuff done. It's not televised.
Right.
We go on when we kick it off, it's Chris Berman goes to the mic just as if it's starting and it's already been going on for 45 minutes. So we do things that, you know, that the public doesn't see.
Yeah, that was the first time, like I said, 2 years ago that I ever went to one, and it did feel different and way cool going to a live event. And I recommend everybody that's listening right now to, when we're opening it back up again next year, to go out there and check it out.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. Most people don't understand either, as probably you didn't, is that, you know, it's a weekend celebration. It's not
no.
It goes on and on and on. And there's a concert with a major act. There's a Gold Jacket dinner. There's a parade with 250,000, 300,000 people at the parade alone. There's autograph sessions. There's all sorts of things going on. So it's well worth it. And sometimes you're a little too close to the forest to see the trees. When I'm yelling about, you know, going an extra 5 minutes, to the guy sitting in the stand, he's mesmerized.
Mm-hmm.
He's listening to every word the guy's saying. And it's one of the most, you know, prolific speeches that have been delivered there. You know, emotional guys break down, you know, the family breaks down, and it's what I miss most about the Hall of Fame. And just the 1 year I've been away, I went to the ceremony, you know, but I wasn't conducting it this time.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was a different feeling for me, but you know, I'll always go. It's important, you know, for the Hall of Famers to go back. I think it's important for fans to go back.
Yeah, and something that I do for the show while I'm there is I have, like, we call them on the street my football moments, where I ask the fans, we record their favorite football moment of all time. And obviously when we're there, it's whatever player they're watching get inducted to the Hall of Fame or one of their favorite. And it's just cool because when I was there, so for instance, the 2018, and they were Bucks fans, and what was the other team? I can't remember, but it was a couple from London that flew over specifically for, and it was just, you know, it was just cool that everywhere around the world, they're flying just for this.
Yeah. We see it and hear it all the time. And, you know, and unfortunately we also see a lot of occasions where it's on somebody's bucket list when they may be terminally ill or they're, you know, and that's emotional, but we're happy that they feel that connected to it, that they want to do it. And whenever we're aware of it, we try to make it a meaningful event for them. But it is, I mean, the bottom line is this is a fan sport, and there's no better fan sport than, you know, pro football. I firmly believe that, not just because I lived right. it. But, you know, it really is. I mean, what other sport can you be married to it for 12 months a year? I mean, it's it truly is, you know, you become totally immersed in it. And it's a sport where you, I mean, I don't know any other business where you know everybody's salary.
Yeah, there you go.
it must be important to them. They want to know how much they make, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I mean, now I'm more into the history too on top of it, but just, of course, I was a fan to begin with, and then fantasy football came around, and oh my goodness, now it's an obsession beyond just being a fan. Now I know every player in the league, I know their stats, I know all these other things, and it's, so we talk about, my grandfather, he's going to be 90 in about 4 months, and unfortunately, as a Lions fan, we talk about this on the show too.
All right, I'm a Bills fan, but the Lions are always my NFC team.
There you go. But yeah, we answer the phone, he goes, are you ready for some football? It doesn't matter if it's like right now, July, if I call him, he'll say, are you ready for some football? We'll hang up. It'll be go Lions. It's just, that's how it's been in our family forever. And that's great. That kind of goes back to like the football family and things like that. You wrote a book. Well, I mean, the most recent book, NFL Century. What was your drive for writing it? And when did you start writing it?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, you know, people say, oh, I was at a retirement project. And I said, well, it ended up being a retirement project, but I didn't intend it to be. I really hadn't been planning a retirement. I knew I was going to have to do it someday, but I didn't go to a publisher and say, I'm going to retire soon. I'm going to write this book. My motivation was about 2 years out, you know, coming up on the 100th anniversary of the league. I felt that there was an opportunity there, but also a need. You know, there's been how many books written on pro football the last, you know, 20 years, a lot, you know, but they mostly focus on the Super Bowl or a specific team or a specific game or an individual or a perspective, even like, you know, kiss and tells are out there. I didn't feel like anybody had really taken a serious attempt at, you know, just a historical, not even a chronology. I did not want it to be a historically, just chronological presentation of the game. That's been done in encyclopedias. I didn't want it to be encyclopedic, and I didn't want it to be just a regurgitation of the same old story. So I said, I'm going to pick stories that are significant in the history of the game, make sure that they're told properly, you know, with accuracy, and then I'm going to add some things that people may not know but are significant or at least interesting, at least to me, and make sure, again, maybe from a different perspective, a different twist, a different voice. Now, the first thing I learned was that there's no way in hell you can write a history of 100-year history of the National Football League in one book. So that said, you know, a whole lot of stories I didn't even touch. There's about four books on the floor right now waiting to be written that I couldn't use all the stories. But what I wanted to do was to take a selection and get as many in there as I could, which means each subject was going to be limited to about 3,500. To 5,000 words. So, you know, you just try telling the story of any of the chapters I took. And that was my biggest challenge, was to get my point across in as few words as that. Most of the chapters were much longer when I wrote them and ended up being what they are. You know, I didn't mean it to be, it wasn't my signature book for a retirement. It was really just because it was the 100th anniversary of the NFL. But now in retirement, I'm kind of looking and saying, you know, I had a few projects that I had to get done. I did a couple of things for the Hall of Fame, a couple of things for the league office, and I'm still dabbling a bit, you know, with things the way they are. Who knows what the season's going to be like? But I am contemplating possibly doing another book. I'm not quite sure what it'll be. There's just so much material that I didn't cover in the first book. Maybe something from there, or maybe something altogether different. Just maybe a single subject. I haven't decided yet, but that's kind of probably on the back burner right at the moment. But you know, I'm busy enough still doing my SiriusXM radio show. Stay busy with that. Talk to Paul on a regular basis, and you know, enjoying life. Got a nice summer home, which I can't go to now because New York State won't let me go to. I live in Ohio, and we're surging in a corona virus thing, so I'm not able to go this week, which bums me out a bit. Hopefully, that's temporary. We all got to do what we have to do to get this thing under control. That's for sure.
Right. Yeah. Once we get this thing under wraps, hopefully things open up and we can get back to normalcy. And one thing that's normal is it's like, man, this year we were supposed to have the 100th birthday celebration. Yeah. And unfortunately, just the timing. So do you see them?
It's going to happen, you know, and it'll be next year. And, you know, what you were saying, just so we're clear, is the Hall of Fame is going to have the centennial celebration with the new centennial class, which that was a big part of one of the things I did in my retirement project was to make that happen, help make that happen. But in any case, it'll happen in 2021. And as they're saying at the Hall of Fame, twice as much fun in 2021. And that's really, when we're talking about the celebration of football, I'm not sure that the fan really cares if it's the 100th or the 101st birthday of the NFL. When you put on an extravaganza of the type of what we're going to do next year in August in Canton, yeah, next summer, trust me, it'll be like nothing else. Canton throws a hell of a party.
There you go. And speaking of that, you talked about some of the things from nowadays and what you're up to now. Let's take a little bit of a challenge for you.
Sure.
Let's go back to May 31st, 1977, my DeLorean. When you're about to embark on your dream job, you didn't really know it. What advice would you give to yourself after knowing 42 years of being in that dream job?
Well, you know, I think I would have, because I went down with the attitude, this will be a 5-year job. I thought I had a 5-year plan, you know, and, you know, that's how I looked at it. I, you know, think I'll use this to, you know, a stepping stone. I would tell myself if I had the opportunity to go back and say, you better think bigger. There's going to be so many opportunities for you to do things, exciting things, interesting things. Be prepared. I didn't think, you know, having visited the Hall of Fame and I saw where it was and you know, where it was kind of flat, I thought of it as see what I can do to, you know, improve it. But at the same time, I didn't really recognize what wonderful opportunities I was going to be provided from the Board of Trustees and the staff that I was going to go work with and for. So I would go back and tell them that there's going to be so much fun, so much opportunity that you can't even imagine having a life that good for 42 years.
Yeah, that's definitely would have been a dream job for me for 42 years as well. And like you said, even at the beginning, someone like Larry Zonka, who's sitting there with the shovel, or whoever the other guys with the shovel, and not realizing where they would be that many years later. It's just something that's pretty cool. And speaking of pretty cool, not knowing where you'd be, again, a virtual keys to my DeLorean. You can go back in time, any point in pro football history, and you can be present for one moment and even ask one question to a person. Where are you going and what are you doing?
Boy, I tell you, there's so many things. I would probably want to go to that 1920 organizational meeting. And if I knew what I know, I'd love to be that guy in the room because they would have me certified. They would just say, this guy's out of his mind. Somebody wrap him up, take him down to the Massillon State Hospital, which was just down the next town down, and lock him up. There's no way that this could be, you know, what we're getting involved in here. So that would be it. And then if I had a second choice, it would be Super Bowl III. And I'd be the guy in the tunnel when Joe Namath is going through with his number one finger up. I'd be reaching for his hand to shake his hand and congratulate him.
Yeah, that'd be another cool story or cool moment to go to as well. And as far as just, again, a wealth of knowledge, and we haven't even tapped the source, just like your first book hasn't tapped the wealth of knowledge you've been able to have. But are there any last words of wisdom or anything like that that you'd like to give to the fans of the show?
Yeah, you know what? I would give anybody listening this, the idea, you know, we just jokingly said it, that, you know, about this, the status of the season and so on, but this too shall pass. And, you know, what seems like a lifetime already, you know, it is, we're talking weeks out of our life. And it's not the end of anything. It's just the beginning of a new season, whether it's in September or next year. You know, things will get better. Things will recover. We got to do our own, do what we can to make it happen. Don't be stupid, you know, wear a mask, keep social distance, and be patient, you know. And this isn't a time to lay blame. This isn't a time to point fingers. This is a time to reach into our soul and say, what can I do to make it better? Get us back on track so we can all enjoy everything from going to the supermarket to going to a football game. And it'll happen. Let's just not make it last any longer than it has to. The wait.
Now, how cool was that? Peeling back the curtains at some of the operations over at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I want to give a big thank you and shout out to Joe Horrigan for taking time out of his retirement to come and share some of these intriguing stories. And also, like I said at the beginning, if you like Joe's work, one of the best things you can do is support him by purchasing his incredible book, NFL Century, The 100-Year Rise of America's Greatest Sports League. Again, there's links over on the website, which you can get to by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com. While you're over there, also check out this week's sponsor, Pro Football Researchers Association, which you can get to by heading to profootballresearchers.com. Also, I ask a favor of you. Why don't you please share this episode with at least one person that you think would benefit from it, for whatever reason. We also have a newsletter at the website, which maybe that's even the easiest way for you to get them to be able to subscribe to the show. Some people just don't know what podcasts are, so maybe we can teach them. And that's one reason why we send them over to thefootballhistorydude.com over at the website, so they can still learn about our amazing great guests. But for now, dudes, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.